It's a real pleasure now, after a fine presentation by Dave, to introduce to you Yupa Zylstra. Yupa Zylstra is a professor of biology at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where he also serves as dean. He's an example of a person who would go deeply into the more reduced field as a reductionist molecular biologist, and as soon as he got there, he began to scramble back up to get an entire worldview. And he's one of the best ecologists I know, but he always keeps telling me he's a molecular biologist. He really isn't. He has integrated so much, and it's a pleasure for us to receive him to speak to us on agriculture, nature, ecology, and ethics, being accountable in God's creation. Yupa.
Okay, thank you, Cal. I could mention that perhaps my interest in biology probably already goes back to Cal's wife, Ruth, who I had when she was teaching as a student teacher. I had her in my class as a teacher, and that certainly was better than the regular teacher I had in the class itself during high school. A topic here deals with the agroecosystem, primarily because I think we are all aware that probably the single most significant impact that humans have on this creation is through its agroecosystem. The largest ecosystem is the agroecosystem, even if we consider its total diversity. And so one of my concerns is, with regard to also now to creation care, is how are we dealing with that agroecosystem? And since humans are dependent upon agriculture, in fact, any civilization is dependent upon agriculture. And wherever agriculture has failed, those civilizations have also failed. And some of that is interestingly chronicled in the book by Jared Diamond, Collapse. Even when talking about the Sumer civilization back several thousand years B.C., it appears that the principal reason for the collapse is that it made use of irrigation. And given the climate, et cetera, and through evaporation, the land eventually became too salty. And all of a sudden, essentially, its base was gone. So given that, I want to perhaps just to raise the question with regard to food security, if indeed our civilization in engaging also in creation care is going to be secure. Food security, I would suggest, is very critical. In fact, I'm convinced it's more critical than what we often refer to, as at least in North America, as military security. If we would put even half of our resources that we do in military security into food security, I think the world as a whole would be more secure, particularly if we do it in terms of the growing population in the developing world. That's a little bit of the context, but given that context, just to remind ourselves that over 700 million people are presently undernourished. And also not only that, as John Houston indicated this morning, 2 billion essentially are in poverty, and 1 billion essentially don't have adequate water, clean water for themselves, and also 2 billion don't have adequate energy, typically, for appropriate development. The projected increase in the human population by about 1.5 billion people by 2020, along with a shift to a greater meat-oriented diet in the low-income population, and China certainly is an indication of that, is going to essentially result in an expected increase of need for food by 2020 of about 40%. Now, that itself, by the way, does not include the recent growth and using grains to biofuels, which has become a little bit of the push by the U.S. administration. And that also, I think, is a significant concern, particularly when the focus on using corn for biofuels and the net gain is at most 10 or 15% is very wrong-headed. And not only that, we are in danger of a competition of food for fuel versus food for grains for fuel versus grains for food. That itself is another issue, but it certainly is related to that. So with regard to food security, some would argue that the only way to meet this demand is through another agricultural revolution, analogous to the Green Revolution of the 60s and 70s. This next revolution, it is claimed, will be a biotechnology revolution grounded in a biogenetic technology. And that's part of the focus that I want to address, and to what extent is that really appropriate. Yet, there is considerable resistance to agricultural biotechnology and to the acceptance of genetically modified foods, GMOs for short. And that resistance certainly is much stronger here in Britain and in Europe than it is in the U.S. In fact, in the U.S., there's very little resistance to that. And in fact, I would say at least 90% of the population, if not 95% or more, are eating some genetically product of genetically modified crop every day, particularly since over half of our corn and soybeans is genetically modified. And in the food processing industry, one of those ingredients from one of those two crops will be in our daily food. Analyzing the resistance to GMOs, as well as the appropriate place for agricultural biotechnology, will be necessary in our pursuit of food security for the human, growing human population. Now, given the tensions, in my view, the development and incorporation of agricultural biotechnology reflects an increasing shift in a paradigm with regard to a basic human need with regard to food. And I want to analyze the paradigm for that. Those who favor the acceptance of agricultural biotechnology generally reflect what I would call a reductionist paradigm. And Cal doesn't quite know where to put me as far as a reductionist or not, but I tend to be a critique of reductionism, I think which he knows as well. Those who resist agricultural biotechnology generally reflect a holistic paradigm. Now, obviously I'm describing two extremes on a spectrum, and there are a lot of people in between, but I think it's helpful to at least see it in that context. And in a fundamental way, the tensions relate to different perspectives on the nature and meaning of food. Let's describe them a little bit more carefully. A reductionist paradigm essentially sees food as basically a form of organic chemical energy. Agriculture in that context is seen as a production of organic chemical energy, typically involving high levels of fossil fuel for production. And in our present food system, if you take the total food system, it approaches about 10 calories of fuel energy for 1 calorie of food energy. So it's that ratio essentially reflects that high reductionism. As long as we get that organic chemical energy that we call food, that's all we're focused on. And if we increase that production, that's the aim of that food system. Whereas the holistic paradigm, food touches upon manifold levels of relationships and contributing to the building and development of community as a cultural expression of human life. So food is then embedded in that community relationships. It's not divorced from it. In this way, community and place are intimately related in a holistic manner to humans. Emphasis is on agroecology as a basic food production. In other words, the primary source of energy is seen as the sun through photosynthesis as the primary input to that, and not necessarily capitalizing on fossil fuels for doing so. So in that sense, I want to emphasize that community and place should be that framework for understanding our sustainability with regard to our food system and the agro-ecosystem. And with regard to that, we need to recognize that humans are primarily relational. Humans are embedded in creational relationships, as any other creature is. Okay? So we can't separate humans in that sense as creatures. And food connects humankind to place and community, just as food connects many other organisms in the ecosystem. In fact, I would say that food is the primary way in which organisms are related to each other. There are some others, but it's an essential way in the analysis of any ecosystem. And all human creatureliness connects humankind to place. Now, what I think is happening, and certainly in our present civilization, is that there is a decline in human connectedness to place. And that's very evident in the food system. The present reductionist food system tends to alienate humans from place. For example, knowing where our food comes from, how it is grown, how it is processed, how it is transported. Keep in mind that at least in North America, the average distance for a typical meal in the U.S. is 1,500 miles. Given that, it's pretty hard to identify your basic human need as far as the community and place from where it's coming from. And so that, of course, also means that it's difficult to be kind of accountable for the source of that basic human need. Now, probably in the UK, not being as large, it's not quite as distant. So some of my comments reflect the U.S. system, but knowing the whole role of globalization, I think all of us know that the globalization is impacting all of the world, not just only North America. The present food system also tends to break human connectedness to community, knowing the farmer who grows the food, the grocer who sells the food, etc. And if we look at the food system, Walmart is the largest grocer now in the world. Okay, Nestle's and Philip Morris are competing for the largest as far as the food system, the largest corporations. And you might know Philip Morris is a cigarette producer, but really they are very big into food. I think they realize that cigarettes is not going to be a long-term solution. Although being here in Britain, I'm amazed if I can make a comment that so many people are smoking. I mean, they do it in North America too, but I find that hasn't changed as much in Britain as it has in the UK. Not that I want to, but it's just an observation I've made in the last 2 weeks being here and traveling around Britain. I see more smoking here than I certainly do in the States. So at least there's one positive thing about North America, even though there's a lot of negatives about it. With regard to that, and then also identifying three major grain companies that expanded into the food system into other levels, there's Cargill, Conagra, and ADM. And one of the speakers this morning referred to the Cargill elsewhere in terms of, I think, in Brazil. Was it? I think Ian did that. And it's one of the three largest grain companies. If you're interested in further analysis of that, Eric Schlosser's book, The Fast Food Nation, and Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore Dilemma, gives a very fascinating analysis of the food system and the dilemmas with regard to that. Now, getting back to the main theme that I want to indicate, that food security is linked to sustainability, is linked to community, which is linked to place. I've highlighted those words, sustainability, community, and place. All of that involves webs of culture, nature, interconnectedness, among, and I've listed a number of them, we can perhaps indicate more. But people to people, then people to land. Those are intimate relationships. Farmer to the consumer. Well, I don't like the word consumer itself. I should put a different word there. But farmer to those who eat the products in which the farmer might be growing. Farmer and the wholesale food company. Farmer and the retailer. Farmer and the supplier of inputs. Farmer and the land. But more importantly also, farmer and the agro-ecosystem. It's not just land, it's an agro-ecosystem. And if it's going to be sustainable, that agro-ecosystem also must follow fundamental ecological principles. And certainly the trend in North American agriculture since the Second World War has been away from that. It's been reductionist and only say, how much can I produce here without making that land sustainable ecologically for the future production in many ways. Furthermore, having this here, I also want to indicate that in our food system, major corporations basically are dominating the consumer, the wholesale food company, the retailer and supplier inputs. And that domination makes it very difficult for the farmer to adequately carry out responsible stewardship of that agro-ecosystem, because that farmer is at the behest of those corporations. And particularly farmers who are, in fact, an effective farmer, there's limits to how much a good farmer can be a good steward in terms of the land that's they are in control of. But that food system essentially wants to deal with few people. So there's a real pressure for larger and larger farmers, and small farmers simply have no market to sell their goods to. At least that's the pattern in North America. So it's very difficult then that we have a structural problem in agriculture where good stewardship is being undermined because the control is essentially more and more through these large corporations. Given that picture, I now want to make a little bit of a shift which will have implications for the biotechnology application. And that is that I've emphasized community relationships. And I would argue that community relationships essentially are not only basic, but they are common in the sense of the commons. Air and sunlight belong to the commons. It's not owned by anyone. And in that regard, I would argue that relationships, in that sense, cannot be privatized. They belong to the commons. For example, familial relationships, parents and children, Parents really don't own children. They have children, but they don't own them. There are relationships in that context, which, of course, entails responsibility of parents to the children, and also the reverse. But it's not one because of ownership. Likewise, I would argue that the employer-employee relationship is not one of ownership, as we have in slavery, okay? But there are obligations in both ways, but it's not one of ownership. Well, in an analogous way, I would argue that relationships at the cell level, cell organism level, genome level, genome organism level, etc., those are relationships, and I would argue that in an analogous way, such relationships cannot be privatized. And that, to me, is a fundamental principle, because what is happening in our genetic biotechnology is essentially the privatization of those relationships. And that itself, I think, is a serious issue, a moral issue, with regard to the application of biotechnology. I think there's a lot of application of biotechnology which is appropriate, but the context and the means by which it's done, I would say, is inappropriate and anormative. And so that becomes then a key point that I want to emphasize and to get across. Okay, now, so in that context then, I would suggest that a central problem in agricultural biotechnology is not its safety, etc., but, because I think by and large many of the products are not necessarily unsafe, but it's the issue of privatization of the interconnections, and as a result, the consequent concentration of power and control at the various levels of interconnectedness. I'd already indicated there's already significant control. Biotechnology, as simply, is a tool in which that control is increased and magnified even more. And that, I think, is a serious threat to sustainability. Just to illustrate, control through the patents. The private companies own about 3/4 of U.S. patents in ag biotechnology. I've listed a few of them. Monsanto being the largest, but DuPont is large, Syngenta. These names may not mean too much because there's been a constant merger of these companies into larger ones, and they sometimes have their name changed. Syngenta, for example, not too many years ago, was Novartis, and so on. So depending upon your familiarity with them, you'll have different means. Some of the other, by the way, 0.25% are owned by universities, and I don't think Cal Mines have been saying that his university is one of the largest universities in terms of patents in biotechnology. And I would even question whether that's appropriate. Okay? He might not agree with me, but at any rate, there's some there. To indicate also the developments, just to indicate the forces that are there, during the period in the 1990s, Monsanto, DuPont, and Novartis spent $30 billion on acquiring other biotech companies. Is that a lot of money? Well, it's certainly, if that $30 billion was spent in the research, in publicly supported research for biotechnology, we probably have better gains. Just for comparison, the USDA budget in 2002 for research, and this is research overall, not just in biotechnology, was a mere $2.1 billion. And if indeed we are serious about the use of biotechnology, increasing that to $100 billion, which would not be that much of a factor considering the total budget, we would probably then have much better development and research and appropriate biotechnology forms than we have now. Furthermore, as indicated here, the presently GMO crops serve largely for control, not food security. There's no evidence in the last 10, 15 years in their presence that it has alleviated the world hunger problem. What we have is simply increasing power. In contrast, the Green Revolution had a success largely related to the scope of the projects in terms of it was public or foundation funding. It was not privatized in that same scale that we have now. Failures of the Green Revolution, and there are some, are very much linked to the lack of paying attention to the interconnectedness to the local community, to the place in which it's applied. Basically, the approach was, well, here's the system, apply it universally, regardless of or ignoring the context of the local place. So, I raise then some questions to end up with as a summary way. Should a basic human need be under the control of a few corporations? Should a basic human need be limited in access and distribution by a powerfully controlled market? Okay? And should those involved in producing food be supported by a just and fair prices? I would argue that this is something we should be supporting. This trend does not give us food security, and furthermore, it does not give us a structure which is going to give the appropriate accountable stewardship at that agro-ecosystem level. There's a corporation is not going to be concerned about sustainability at the agro-ecosystem level. I would argue that small farmers have a greater chance of doing so. Some of them might neglect it, but in the sense that we want to increase human response and accountability, we need a paradigm in which production is not the only goal, and not even the primary goal, but sustainable agriculture. And sustainable agriculture is then, as a key to food security, is going to be accomplished more effectively through small and peasant farmers than it is through large corporations. And so to be able to accomplish that, what we need to do, essentially, is work for public support for such research rather than the privatization of it, because the privatization of it is not going to have the complex issues and levels of complexity at the agro-ecosystem level in the rural communities in mind in terms of accomplishing that. So, to conclude, I would suggest that food security is dependent upon what I would call the democratization of food production resources, the decentralization of control at all levels in that community, including particularly as far as the small farmers and in that community. Food security is dependent upon a democratization of food markets so everyone can participate. The 2 billion people who will make less than $2 a day really can't participate in that market, which typifies our present food system. Sustainable agriculture requires democratization of agricultural practices, which allows for appropriate control at the local control and accountability. And in that context, real freedom entails potential to be accountable, and it's a freedom for doing something right, not just freedom from, for example, government control. And oftentimes that's the way freedom is defined, or people say, well, I'm not free because I'm being impinged upon certain regulations. But we need to see freedom as being the opportunity to be accountable, recognizing that the Lord wanted everybody to have the opportunity for accountability. That's my conclusion.
Very good. Thank you.
John has a question.
Yeah, I'm sure we all felt the pressure to answer no, no, yes to your question. That's great. But my hissing question to you is, how do we unpick it? And I draw the parallels with the pharmaceutical industry, which also exploits the poor in your country and in mine and throughout Africa and Asia. Because it is also there.
Yeah, I recognize there's a real parallel, also a difference, and partly because of time constraints, I focus on the agriculture. Some of the issues can also be applied to the pharmaceutical industry. Pharmaceutical industry, and of course, some of these companies are involved as well.
Absolutely. So how are we going to unpick it?
To unpack it, I think what we need to, well, obviously, I think we need to readdress the whole patenting law. I think the patenting law that we have regarding such applications are inordinate, immoral. Okay, that's one step. Once we do that, of course, that's one step. The other one is that we need to, through our political policy, develop economic policies that will encourage and support local communities, small farmers, whereas in contrast, our policy, by and large, are defined and shaped by agribusiness, and they determine the policies, and of course, the policies essentially encourage business. Earl Butts, who was the Secretary of Agriculture for Richard Nixon back in the 70s, said, get bigger, get out. Well, that attitude has shaped, certainly in the U.S., agriculture policy. Well, that's got to be changed. That takes political will, but also at the economic policy level. So that's where we have to focus to address these kind of problems. But I think we need to be aware of it and we need to do so. If we don't, We can do all kinds of things at a very small level, but we're not going to affect what I would consider to be a major impact on ecosystems globally.
Just an observation, really, that we can all change where we shop. So, for example, go to the farmer's market, not Walmart. You know, if maybe Christians spend their income wisely, that would have an impact.
And that certainly is an important area of cut at the individual level, but it won't be enough.
No, it won't.
It's going to be further than that.
Yeah.
Because those in Eric Schlesinger's book, Fascination, had an interesting comment that when it came to the slaughter industry, the slaughterhouses, they did not, there's regulations by the USDA about how to maintain appropriate safety in the slaughterhouses. They basically ignored it until McDonald's said, we only want meat that's going to have been processed under those conditions. They changed overnight.
Wow.
So it isn't that they cook. The unfortunate thing is, why does it take McDonald's to do that? And that's, so in other words, it's grateful. For one thing, I can be grateful for McDonald's for forcing that, but they are part of the same food system because they will only buy products from large corporations. They're not going to buy the potatoes or the fries from the small farm.
Other questions?
Yes. I'm a bit concerned about the strict dichotomy between reductionism and holistic thought. Because, for example, much of the advances in ecological science over the last 50 years have been through quantitative mathematical modelling, people like Roy Anderson and Bob May, and that really you can picture as very reductionist, and yet they've taught us an awful lot about our ecosystems, including our agro-ecosystems. Another contrast between the USA and EU perspective might be that we will use, in our agro-ecosystems, we'll use things like conservation headlands, our EU subsidies now, instead of going towards production, are now going towards conservation, beetle banks, other methods of integrated pest management. So again, I don't see reductionism as being wholly bad. And finally, the other difference between the EU and America you've mentioned, and that is that we do have great concerns about safety biotech. Those great concerns are translated into a very cumbersome risk assessment procedure, which costs a great deal of money for companies to get through. Increasingly, it's only very big companies that can afford to get an application through the European regulation side.
I agree there. One comment with regard to the reductionism. I'm not saying that research, obviously as a molecular biologist who's working at the technology that helps, in quote, because it's at a very narrow level of reduction. But what I am trying to say is that research by itself should not determine what we are doing. In order to apply that research, then it's got to be in the context of research at all these different levels that I've referred to. And that can only be done, I would say, by publicly funded research. Because no private corporation is going to do that manifold level of research. So any particular research is going to require, you might say, a level of research. But it can't be isolated for that. And our present food system tends to look at this level as the answer to this problem, and it doesn't see the total context. And any application has to see the total context in that community. So if you're going to develop a particular GMO, a particular product, you have to do that in terms of, is it appropriate for that community, for that locality? And in some localities, as Ian indicated this morning, sometimes that could be a development of appropriate drought-resistant crop. But obviously up to this point, we haven't done it because it hasn't been in the interest of the food industry because they're not going to make money on that. Okay? Now, I guess, can I make one comment? Yeah. And that relates to a comment that Les made. Because Les talked about creation care in the wheat. And one of the questions I was going to ask is, who is the wheat? And we tend to universalize. And what comes out of this presentation that I've had is, in some ways, the weed is that the huge food corporations that are there, because they are the ones that are setting policy and making decisions. However, those corporations essentially are corporations in which the owners are shareholders. The managers essentially are managing for the shareholders. The shareholders have very little interest besides getting a profit on your investment. Very frankly, I'm one of those for my pension. So it's a very strange wheel where accountability is being shifted and lost in the present structure of our corporation, because managers don't see that they are accountable for creation care. And the shareholders, who are then the owners of that system, are so far removed from those decisions that they can't exercise that. So I think there's a structural evil there that I'm not so sure how to resolve, except that we have some significant changes in our economic systems. That's just a kind of a concluding comment that for me has been a very personal dilemma. What do I do with my pension, since that's my main investment? But the system now is set up such that it's guaranteed that the rich become richer, because only those who have money can invest, and the whole economic structure is essentially going to benefit those who can invest. And so it's designed to have an increasing concentration of those corporations. That, to me, is a key problem that can somehow shows a tension between economy and ecology.
You can have the last question.
Do you not think that more microcredit in the poor agro systems would help on this?
It definitely would help. But then that also requires significant efforts in that direction. Mm-hmm. And I think the World Bank is making a shift from 15, 20 years ago, but it's going to be much more expensive. So I do see some signs to it. I'm not sure if that's adequate to stem the tide of the large global corporations.
But it is another thing that Christians could be active in stimulating.
Very much so.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we thank you, Yuko, for this fine presentation and for also exemplifying an integration that we really have been emphasizing for this whole session today. So thank you very much. I would like to thank again Les Batty. Maybe you could just rise with applause at the end. Les Batty, Michelle Haynes, David Campbell, and Yuko Zadistra. Thanks to all of you for your good questions. We hope that you will carry lessons home with you that will be implemented and in time will transform. Blessings to you all.
have the Wild West.
Well, I'm more time yet with the University of Wisconsin. But what I've done is I've shifted.